thank you also from my side for coming out on this Friday afternoon, even if it's just from next door. I know you're all very busy. But this is an important topic, and I didn't choose it for antiquarian interests, but because it has something to say to us as we are moving forward. Almost exactly 1 year ago, on December 3rd, 2012, the Catholic layman Devasahayam Pillai was beatified in Nagarkoil in the southern state of Tamil Nadu, India. Belonging to an upper caste family, Blessed Pillai had encountered the Christian faith while a soldier. In 1745, at the age of 33, he was baptized and received the name Devasahayam, a Tamil rendering of the biblical name Lazar, God has helped. In 1752, after enduring imprisonment and brutal torture for 3 long years, Blessed Pillai was executed for refusing to renounce the Catholic faith. The Catholic Church recognized Blessed Pillai as having undergone death voluntarily in odium fidei, because of hatred against the faith. His was a martyrdom pro fide, for the sake of the faith. A bit over half a year ago, on May 25th, 2013, Father Giuseppe Puglisi was beatified in Palermo, Sicily. In 1993, on his 56th birthday, he had been assassinated by mafia killers. The Catholic Church acknowledged Blessed Giuseppe Puglisi to have died a martyr. But he did not die because his murderers hated the Catholic faith and thus persecuted the faithful, and especially prelates and priests. Rather, he was murdered because of his unequivocal witness as a parish priest to truth and justice. In his local context in Palermo, this meant not only to avoid any lie and secrecy about the activities of the mafia, but rather actively to give witness to truth and justice in order to protect persons, especially teenagers and young adults, from the mafia's pernicious influence. The Catholic Church recognized Father Puglisi to have died in odium virtutis et veritatis, because of hatred against virtue and truth. How does the criterion for the martyrdom of Blessed Giuseppe Puglisi relate to the criterion for the martyrdom of Blessed Pillai? Does the former criterion, martyrdom because of the hatred against virtue and truth, replace, expand, or develop the traditional criterion, martyrdom because of the hatred of the faith? To put the question in paradigmatic biblical terms, how does the martyrdom of John the Baptist, who, as the Roman Missal puts it, gave his life in witness to truth and justice, because he denounced Herod's living in open contempt of the divine law, relate to the martyrdom of Stephen the deacon and James the apostle, who were killed because they publicly testified to Christ? In this lecture, I wish to display the ongoing theological relevance of Thomas Aquinas' teaching on martyrdom. Thomas's careful construal of the act of martyrdom gives rise to a nuanced notion of martyrdom, a notion that affords a theologically sound integration of the criterion for understanding death voluntarily in odium virtutis et veritatis, because of hatred against virtue and truth, into the paradigmatic criterion of undergoing death voluntarily in odium fidei, because of hatred against the faith. First, therefore, Thomas on the cardinal virtue of fortitude. Thomas Aquinas defines martyrdom as the principal act of the virtue of fortitude. In order fully to appreciate all the entailments of this definition, it is imperative to attend to the virtue of fortitude, or courage. Fortitudo. One of the so-called four cardinal virtues. The other three are prudence, justice, and temperance. Now, a cardinal or principal virtue is one on which the other virtues depend or hang, just like a door depends or hangs on a hinge, cardo. Furthermore, the cardinal virtues have a special claim to that which is characteristically common among the virtues, and that is first and foremost to act steadfastly. Among the four cardinal virtues, there obtains a distinct hierarchy. Cognizance of this hierarchy is indispensable for a proper understanding of fortitude's principal act, first in relationship to the other cardinal virtues, and second in relationship to the theological virtues faith, hope, and charity. The hierarchy of virtues arises, according to Thomas, from two principles. First, the better a virtue is, the higher it ranks. Second, good in human acts depends on these acts being regulated by a due rule. From this principle follows a third principle, namely that human virtue, which is a principle of good acts, must consist in attaining the due rule of human acts. But what are those regulae or rules? According to Thomas, there exist two such rules, one governing the other. The first is God, and the second is reason, as regulated by God. The three theological virtues, faith, hope, and charity, directly attain the first rule, God. The intellectual and moral and the moral virtues, however, only attain the second rule, human reason. Among the theological virtues, the virtue ranks highest that most attains God, and that is, of course, charity. We come back to that later. Among the cardinal virtues, the virtue ranks highest that most attains the second rule, human reason. Since reason is perfected by prudence, prudence is the first and highest in the order of cardinal virtues. The virtue of justice realizes this good of reason among human beings, for it is the nature of justice to establish the order of reason in all human affairs. Fortitude and temperance safeguard this good by moderating the acts of the sense appetite, the passions, lest human beings are drawn away from the good of reason by the fear of bodily pain and death, or by the attraction of sensual pleasure. Because the fear of danger and death has the greatest power to withdraw a person from the good of reason, fortitude ranks above temperance, the latter moderating or withholding the appetite from sensual pleasure. In light of its position in the hierarchy of cardinal virtues, Thomas characterizes fortitude the following way. Fortitude is about the greatest dangers wherein one must proceed with caution. Unquote. This is from question 140 in the Secunda Secundae, article 2. The proper correlate to the cardinal virtue of fortitude is the danger of death. And the principal act of fortitude is endurance. That is the strength to continue to pursue the good of reason as specified by prudence, even under the threat of death, an endurance that moderates fear and curbs daring. The danger of death is faced first and foremost in combat, but also, Thomas emphasizes, in other dangerous situations. Quote, a brave person behaves well in face of dangers of any other kind of death, especially since a person may be in danger of any kind of death on account of virtue. Thus may a person not fail to attend on a sick friend through fear of deadly infection, or not refuse to undertake a journey with some godly object in view through fear of shipwreck or robbers. Unquote. The situation of spiritual combat applies finally to the martyr. Thomas states, Martyrs face the fight that is waged against their own person, and this for the sake of the sovereign good, the summum bonum, which is God. Wherefore their fortitude is praised above all. Nor is it outside the genus of fortitude that regards warlike actions, for which reason they are said to have been valiant in battle. Fortes facti in bello, that's Hebrews 11:34, unquote. Fortitude may subsist in a person as an acquired moral virtue, but also as a so-called infused moral virtue, infused together with the theological virtue of charity. While the acquired virtue of fortitude is directed to the common good, the infused virtue of fortitude is directed to the supernatural final end, the enjoyment of God, an end that the faithful inchoatively behold and attain by way of the theological virtues. The acquired virtue of fortitude is essentially civic virtue that strengthens a person's mind in matters of human justice, while the gratuitously infused virtue of fortitude strengthens a person's soul in the good of divine justice. Now, Thomas makes an important point here about civic virtue, a point that comes to be important a little bit later. Under the condition of human nature, wounded by sin, the acquired cardinal virtue of fortitude cannot reach the ideal of perfect virtue. However, because civic virtue is directed to the welfare of the body politic of the state, it is a true virtue, albeit imperfect. Imperfect unless, Thomas emphasizes, unless it is referred by charity to the final end and to the perfect good, the enjoyment of God. Keep that in mind. It will play a role. We will now have a closer look at Thomas's argumentation in question 124 of the Secunda Secundae of the Summa Theologiae, where he considers martyrdom as the principal act of fortitude. He doesn't say it, but of course he means infused fortitude here. I intend to show that according to Thomas, an act of civic fortitude, when referred by charity to God as a witness to the divine law, a witness endured even in the face of the danger of death, and indeed endured while being put to death, thus become formally congruent with the act of martyrdom, characteristic of the infused virtue of fortitude. So, second, martyrdom, the principal act of fortitude. As endurance is the principal act of acquired virtue, of the acquired virtue of fortitude, martyrdom is the principal act of the infused virtue of fortitude, which, being always already informed by charity and sustained by infused patience and perseverance, is intrinsically referred to love of God and neighbor. Thomas states, pithily as a summary, martyrdom consists essentially in standing firmly to truth and justice against the assaults of persecution. In the first four articles of question 124 of the Secunda Secundae, Thomas establishes, first, that martyrdom is a virtuous act, second, that it is an act of fortitude, third, that it is an act of the greatest perfection, and fourth, that death is essential to the perfect notion of martyrdom. In the fifth article, finally, Thomas addresses directly the question that concerns us most. Is faith alone, sola fides, the cause of the act of martyrdom? While his previous discussion has prepared the direction Thomas takes on this matter, the set contra he advances does not permit any lingering doubt, for here he takes a central passage from Christ's Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 5:10, the eighth beatitude. To refer to martyrdom, an interpretation that is backed by the Glossa Ordinaria. Blessed are those who are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. In his response, Thomas first recapitulates what he established in the previous articles. Quote, martyrs are so called as being witnesses, because by suffering in body unto death, they bear witness to the truth, not indeed to any truth, but to the truth which is in accordance with godliness, and was made known to us by Christ. Wherefore Christ's martyrs are his witnesses. Now this truth is the truth of faith. Wherefore the cause of martyrdom is the truth of faith. Unquote. Martyrdom is always axiomatically martyrdom for the truth of faith. That is, the final cause of every act of martyrdom is the truth of faith. But since the truth of faith includes the truth of the divine law that yields the measure for all the moral virtues, the act of martyrdom seems to be formally constituted by the truth of the divine faith, for we must remember in matters of human agency the form of the act is largely constituted by its end, the final cause. But martyrdom seems to include materially the way of life in word and deed that gives rise to the hatred against virtue and truth in those who find themselves challenged or even convicted by this way of life. Thomas continues his answer in a way that fully affirms this initial assumption. Quote, but the truth of faith includes not only inward belief, but also outward profession, which is expressed not only by words whereby one confesses the faith, but also by deeds whereby a person shows that he has faith. According to James 2:18, I will show thee by works my faith. Thus all virtuous deeds, inasmuch as they are referred to God, are professions of the faith, whereby we come to know that God requires these works of us and rewards us for them. And in this way they can be the cause of martyrdom. For this reason the Church celebrates the martyrdom of Blessed John the Baptist, who suffered death not for refusing to deny the faith, but for reproving adultery. Unquote. John the Baptist is the paradigm for martyrdom for the sake of virtue and truth. The principles of this martyrdom are, all virtuous acts, inasmuch as they are referred to God, are professions of the faith. Faith is formally constituted by the certain revealed knowledge that virtuous acts pursuing good and avoiding sin are required by God and are integral to friendship with God. This makes faith the final cause of martyrdom. Faith in its proper constitution, however, is informed by charity. Quote, for the act of faith is directed to the object of the will, the good, as to its end. And this good, which is the end of faith, that is the divine good, is the proper object of charity. Therefore, charity is called the form of faith insofar as the act of faith is perfected and formed by charity. This is from the Treatise on Faith in the Secunda Secundae, question 4. Thomas understands charity as perfecting and thus forming faith in the sense of charity quickening the act of faith. Faith as a perfecting habitus of the intellect makes present to the will the last end, and charity as the perfecting habitus of the will desires the last end, God, the summum bonum. Hence, in the sense of quickening or informing the acts of all the other virtues, charity directs the act of all the other virtues to the last end and consequently gives the form to all other acts of virtue. Therefore, faith and charity both command the act of all the other virtues, faith as final cause and charity as efficient cause. By making the surpassing good of the ultimate end present to the will, faith as final cause enabling the efficient cause charity, faith thereby commands the act of martyrdom in the order of finality. For the sake of love of God and neighbor, charity in turn commands the act of martyrdom, now in the order of efficacy. Quote, inward faith with the aid of charity causes all outward acts of virtue by means of the other virtues, commanding but not eliciting them. Unquote. The higher virtues of intellect and will, especially the theological virtues, faith and charity, command the acts of the moral virtues, acts that are mediated by the specific habitus to which these acts belong, acts specified by their object. While commanded by the higher virtues, these habitus, however, immediately elicit their proper acts. The habitus of fortitude principally elicits the act of endurance, while the habitus of patience elicits its continuation, and the habitus of perseverance its completion. When commanded by an ever greater charity and thereby referred to God with ever greater intensity, the habitus of fortitude elicits its perfect act, which is endurance usque ad sanguinem, to the shedding of one's blood, the act of perfect martyrdom. In his response to the three objections, Thomas defends, applies, and even extends this principle. All three objections forward in different ways a well-known position. Allegedly, faith alone, sola fides, that is the public verbal confession of the Christian faith, is the sole cause of martyrdom, the decisive motive cause in the persecutors, therefore must be exclusively odium fidei, hatred against the faith. That's the position of the objection. Based on 1 Peter 4, the first objection argues that one is said to be a Christian because one holds the Christian faith, and therefore it is only the faith in Christ that gives glory of martyrdom to those who suffer. Thomas grants the principle that faith in Christ is constitutive of martyrdom, but differentiates between the public verbal confession of the faith and the public witness that is entailed in living a virtuous Christian life. Quote, a Christian is one who is Christ's. Now, a person is said to be Christ's not only through having faith in Christ, but also because he or she is actuated to virtuous deeds by the Spirit of Christ. And again, because in imitation of Christ, the faithful is dead to sins, according to Galatians 5. They are Christ's that have crucified their flesh with the vices, with its vices and concupiscences. Hence, to suffer as a Christian is not only to suffer in confession of the faith, Thomas emphasizes, which is done by words, but also to suffer for doing any good work or for avoiding any sin for Christ's sake, because this all comes under the head of witnessing to the faith. Unquote. Hence, not only were St. John of Cologne, a Dominican, and St. Fidelis of Sigmaringen, a Franciscan Capuchin, who were both killed because of their witness to the Catholic faith, martyrs, but also was St. Maria Goretti, who was killed in defending her chastity, a martyr. The doing of any good and the avoidance of sin are commanded and thus informed by charity, and by way of charity they are referred to God. These virtuous acts are as such a testifying of the faith, because divine faith yields the knowledge of God's truth that guides infused prudence in determining how best to refer all specific human acts to God. And here comes the second objection into play. If a martyr is a kind of witness and witnesses born to the truth alone, could one then not be called a martyr for upholding the truths of geometry? Think about it. Well, Thomas doesn't spend much time on that. This is obviously absurd. Hence, only the divine truth which is held, this is the objection still, it plays it out, and then it says it's absurd. Hence, only the divine truth which is held by faith alone is the cause of martyrdom. We are back to faith alone. In his reply, Thomas first points to the crucial connection between martyrdom and truths that pertain to the worship of the Godhead, the cultus divinitatis, and hence are called truths according to godliness, secundum pietatem. Thomas appeals here somewhat obliquely to the virtue of religion, a virtue annexed to the virtue of justice. The first and principal act of the virtue of religion is the interior act of devotion, the submission of one's will to God, to God's will, and hence to the divine law. All the other acts of the virtue of religion, and indeed all the other moral virtues, have their end and purpose in the act of devotion. As a potential part of justice and being due to God qua Creator, the act of devotion commanded by charity realizes the rectitude of the will, of one's own will, in relationship to God. The act of devotion commits the will to the service of God according to God's will as expressed in the divine law. All truth according to godliness, secundum pietatem, falls under the divine law. And then Thomas states, in response to the objection, since every lie is a sin, avoidance of a lie, to whatever truth it may be contrary, may be the cause of martyrdom, inasmuch as a lie is a sin against the divine law. Unquote. Hence the defense of any truth, be it theoretical or factual, can become the cause of martyrdom, given that the observance of the divine law belongs essentially to the cultus divinitatis, to which pertains the virtue of religion, and whose principal act is the act of devotion. The devout person does not lie because the divine law prohibits lying, which in its core is nothing but duplicity, and prescribes acts of the virtue of veracitas, truthfulness. Hence the defense of any truth can become the cause of martyrdom whenever its denial is understood as unfaithfulness to the divine law and consequently as a betrayal of what pertains essentially to the first and principal act of the cultus divinitatis, interior devotion. The third objection focuses on the common good by arguing that those virtuous acts that are directed to the common good are preferable and more important than those that do not. And since according to Nicomachean Ethics 1-2, the good of the body politic, the res publica, is better than the good of the private person, it seems that those who die in defense of the res publica should be regarded as martyrs. That's still the objection. But this does contradict the established practice of the Church, which does not celebrate those as martyrs who die defending their res publica in a just war. Hence, faith alone, sola fides, must be the cause of martyrdom. In his response to the third objection, Thomas affirms the superiority of the common good over the private good. First move. In a second step, however, he integrates this hierarchy of the human good, common good over private good, in the natural order, into an encompassing and perfecting hierarchy of the divine good, where the common good is indistinguishable from the private good, in the supernatural order. While the good of one's res publica is most eminent among human goods, the divine good still is better than the human good. Remember, according to Thomas, the divine good is that which the theological virtues already somewhat attain, and that to which all moral virtues are directed by the virtue of religion. The divine good is the cause of martyrdom. But then Thomas adds significantly, quote, since human good may become divine, for instance, when it is referred to God, it follows that any human good, insofar as it is referred to God, may be the cause of martyrdom. Unquote. Among human goods, the most eminent is the common good of the res publica. Hence, the defense of the res publica is a good superior to any merely private human good. But the divine good, the summum bonum, being the ultimate common good, is an infinitely higher common good than the proximate common good of the res publica. Can acts of virtue pertaining to the proximate common good be referred to the ultimate common good? In other words, can a death suffered in defense of the res publica and referred to God by charity qualify as martyrdom? Thomas's answer seems to imply a positive response. And indeed, in an earlier parallel discussion, Thomas holds this position explicitly. I give you a quote from the young Thomas now. Quote, "The uncreated good surpasses all created good. Hence, any created end, whether it be in common or a private good, cannot confer so great a goodness on an act as can the uncreated end, when an act is done for God's sake. Hence, when a person dies for the common good without referring it to Christ, he will not merit the aureole. But if he refer it to Christ, he will merit the aureole, and he will be a martyr. For instance, if he defend his country from an attack of an enemy who designs to corrupt the faith of Christ, and suffer death in that defense." Unquote. I don't need to give you historical examples. I'm sure you go mentally to all the right places already that give you connotations in the medieval context. This is the position of the young Thomas in the process of completing his extensive commentary on Peter Lombard's Sentences. This is from Sentences, Commentary on Sentences, Book 4, Distinction 49, 5-3. I can give you the, if you need the place. By the time Thomas composes the disputed questions on truth, his position has developed. His more nuanced position he continues to hold until relatively late in his life when he worked on the disputed questions of on evil. In the disputed questions on truth, he states, quote, "In one who has charity, there can be no act of virtue not formed by charity. For either the act will be directed to the proper end, and this can be only through charity in one who has charity, or the act is not directed to the proper end, and so is not an act of virtue." Unquote. On the supposition that the Christian soldier who defends his country from an attack of an enemy who designs to corrupt the faith of Christ has charity, he must refer this act, elicited by acquired fortitude, to the supernatural end. Without such a reference, the soldier's act would indeed be a blameful act, according to Thomas. Given such a reference, however, the act does become formally congruent with an act elicited by the infused virtue of fortitude, where such a reference is intrinsic to the constitution of infused virtue. But what about the matter of this kind of act of fortitude referred by charity to the supernatural final end? Is it a proper matter for martyrdom before Christ? Is dying in battle in defense of one's res publica Christiana the proper matter? We are well aware of the fact that all modern nation-states have happily adopted the rhetoric of martyrdom for soldiers fallen in defense of the patria. You all know the word, dulce et decorum est pro patria mori. It is sweet and fitting to die for your country. The Magisterium of the Catholic Church, however, does not acknowledge as a proper matter for martyrdom before the Church the natural good of voluntary death in battle for the justified defense of the res publica, even when most obviously and explicitly referred by charity to God, the supernatural final end. In Book 3, Chapter 18 of his important work, De Servorum Dei Beatificatione et Beatorum Canonizione, on the beatification and canonization of the servants of God, Cardinal Prosper Lambertini, the later Pope Benedict XIV, we we're talking the 18th century, early 18th century here, offers an extensive discussion of the above text by Thomas and of its commentaries and affirms that a necessary condition for the perfect notion of martyrdom is the perfect imitation of Christ. That is specifically the non-resistance against the attackers, persecutors, and eventually executioners of death. Hence, the matter of the kind of act that leads to the death of the Christian soldier dying in defense of the res publica, referred by charity to God, might per se be licit, a licit act. However, the matter of this kind of act lacks a crucial perfection characteristic of the perfection of martyrdom. The perfect imitation of Christ, that is the voluntary undergoing of death without resistance. Due to its imperfect imitation of Christ, this kind of act does not qualify as proper matter for martyrdom before the Church. Noteworthily, the magisterial criterion of non-resistance does not undercut Thomas's argument. Rather, it provides a careful magisterial precision and circumscription in a way that integrates Thomas's position into the older patristic tradition. Non-resistance constitutes an essential characteristic of the proper matter of the kind of acts of martyrdom before the Church. Because this characteristic resembles most closely the imitation of Christ. This circumscription in place, the magisterium actually affirms the basic thrust of Thomas's argument, such that it indeed accounts for the martyrdom of Father Puglisi. We are back in Palermo in the 20th century. First, Father Puglisi witnessed as a Catholic priest to the divine truth as received by the Catholic faith. His testifying to the truth entailed his witness in word and action to virtue and justice and to their rule, the divine law. Second, Father Puglisi was deeply committed to the common good of the res publica he served in as priest and as citizen, a commitment that as priest he constantly referred by charity to God. Third, Father Puglisi underwent death voluntarily without resisting his assassins. As they witnessed later, he, as a matter of fact, said, "I expected you coming." That was their witness later. They talked about it. Father Puglisi's case discloses the perennially true core of Thomas's argument. Any act of witness to virtue and justice is a defense of the res publica, and if this defense is referred to by charity to God, the person who is killed without offering resistance for the sake of the witness to virtue and justice can indeed be acknowledged as martyr before the Church. Conversely, Thomas's thesis, rightly understood, discloses what is unique about the kind of martyrdom Father Puglisi's prophetic witness and death represent. It is a martyrdom whose proximate cause was the seal for the common good of the res publica, referred by charity to the divine good, the common good of the Civitas Dei, the heavenly city. For nothing, with the exception of a criminal and corrupt political regime, undercuts the common good of a res publica more than widespread organized and secretive crime that involves corruption, fraud, extortion, blackmailing, money laundering, and murder. When motivated by love of God and neighbor, and undertaken with a goal of redirecting the human good of the res publica to the divine good of the heavenly city, such that the defense of the common good of the res publica becomes formally congruent with directing persons to the common good of the heavenly city, which is the end of faith, exposing, condemning, and fighting such organized crime can thus be a proximate cause of authentic martyrdom. The case for such a martyrdom is made by Thomas's argument as affirmed and magisterially specified by the norm of non-resistance. Blessed Giuseppe Puglisi's martyrdom for the sake of virtue and truth follows a paradigm set by St. Thomas More and St. John Fisher, but now opens up this paradigm in a secular Western world in ways that make it possible to consider along similar lines theologically the death of the servant of God, Archbishop Oscar Romero, as well as many priests, religious, and laypersons who were killed in the 20th century because they testified to virtue and truth, not to forget the priests, religious, and laypersons who were executed or tortured to death in Nazi Germany. According to Thomas Edison's analysis, martyrdom is always a divine gift of grace, and what is meritorious about it is the depth of the act of charity, of friendship with the triune God that follows through on the gift of grace and commands the act of martyrdom. The heroism of martyrdom is in the end always a heroism of friendship with God. By remaining faithful to the will of God as revealed in the divine law, and thereby testifying to the divine truth. While martyrdom's final cause is faith, its primary motive cause is charity, an efficacy perfected by the exterior motion of divine inspiration, which is the gift of fortitude, one of the Holy Spirit's seven gifts. Yet the proximate cause for the act of martyrdom is all that comes under the head of witnessing to the faith, which includes the doing of any good work and the avoidance of any sin. Consequently, according to Thomas, martyrdom for the sake of virtue and truth does not replace, expand, or develop martyrdom for the sake of the faith. Rather, the former, martyrdom for the sake of virtue and truth, is genuinely integral to the latter, martyrdom for the sake of the faith. The fundamental principle pertains to every form of authentic martyrdom. Quote, the cause of all martyrdom is the truth of faith. Unquote. Third, and finally and briefly, the ongoing relevance of Thomas's integral doctrine of martyrdom. It is time for some concluding observations that bring us right back into the present. The degree to which important papal communications from the pen of John Paul II and Benedict XVI have implicitly affirmed Thomas's integral doctrine of martyrdom is nothing short of remarkable. The year 2013 marks the 20th anniversary of Blessed Pope John Paul II's encyclical letter Veritatis Splendor. Hence, it is especially appropriate to recall the important teaching on martyrdom that this encyclical letter advances in its third part, which carries the title Martyrdom, the Exaltation of the Inviolable Holiness of God's Law. For the encyclical addresses directly the question what it means to testify to the truth in a secular world of deeply disturbing moral waywardness. I give you one brief quote instead of a longer discussion. The quote is from paragraph 93 of Veritatis Splendor, and that stands in for a wider discussion. Martyrdom, the encyclical teaches, is an outstanding sign of the holiness of the Church. Fidelity to God's holy law, witnessed to by death, is a solemn proclamation and missionary commitment, usque ad sanguinem, so that the splendor of moral truth may be undimmed in the behavior and thinking of individuals and society. This witness makes an extraordinarily valuable contribution to warding off in civil society and within the ecclesial communities themselves a headlong plunge into the most dangerous crisis which can afflict humanity, the confusion between good and evil, which makes it impossible to build up and to preserve the moral order of individuals and communities. By the eloquent and attractive example of a life completely transfigured by the splendor of moral truth, the martyrs, and in general, all the Church's saints, light up every period of history by reawakening its moral sense. By witnessing fully to the good, they are a living reproof to those who transgress the law. So far, Veritatis Splendor. Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI, in an important letter, continues to emphasize the different shape martyrdom takes in profoundly changed cultural contexts. He states, "The martyrs of the past and those of our times gave and give life freely and consciously in a supreme act of love, witnessing to their faithfulness to Christ, to the gospel, and to the church. If the motive that impels them to martyrdom remains unchanged, since Christ is their source and their model, then what has changed are the cultural contexts of martyrdom and the strategies ex parte persecutoris, the strategies on the side of the persecutors, that more and more seldom explicitly show their aversion to the Christian faith or to a form of conduct connected with the Christian virtues, but simulate different reasons, for example, of a political or social nature. Unquote. In the Western secular societies, the odium fidei, the hatred against the faith on the side of the persecutors of the faith, is increasingly camouflaged behind political and social ideals and norms propagating human progress, liberation, and authenticity along the lines of a collectivized radical individualism. Ideals and norms that are increasingly enforced by way of legal regulations that contradict the gospel and human dignity. In such a setting, authentic Christian witness is unavoidably a sign of contradiction. Depending on what the particular focus of this witness is, it might become the occasion for strong opposition, for social ostracization, and even persecution. It was not hyperbole or alarmism, but rather sober Christian realism faced with an increasingly militant secularism that moved Francis Cardinal George to make the famous remark to a group of priests that he might very well die peacefully in his bed, but that his successor as Archbishop of Chicago might quite likely die in prison, and his successor would die a martyr in the public square. In his arresting remark, Cardinal George only took seriously some features characteristic of contemporary Western aggressively secular democratic regimes: an increasing religious and ideological pluralism driven by the strong operative belief in a naturalistically conceived sovereign self, an operative belief implemented by an increasingly aggressive state-enforced laicism, eager to introduce innumerable legal instruments of an invasive secularist normativity that insinuates matters of transcendent truth as arbitrary or non-existent, and as hence irrelevant to human flourishing. In such a socio-political setting, testifying to the truth by way of prophetic acts of witnessing to virtue and justice becomes increasingly relevant as a preparatio evangelii. For an increasing number of people, at least in the West, such Christian witness might be the first, albeit indirect, encounter with the gospel. In such a setting, the witness of virtue and truth is nothing but a missionary prototype in extremis of testifying to the divine truth, who is Christ. Pope Francis, most recently, continues to remind us that such a witness must always be informed by charity in order to bear fruit. There is no authentic martyrdom without charity. This, of course, is exactly Thomas's teaching. While not all Christians are called to the perfect act of martyrdom, all Christians are called to testify to the truth and hence to acts of inchoative martyrdom. Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI, who on August 11, 2010, on the occasion of the memorial of St. John the Baptist's martyrdom, stated, "Dear brothers and sisters, celebrating the martyrdom of St. John the Baptist reminds us too, Christians of this time, that with love for Christ, for his words, and for the truth, we cannot stoop to compromises. The truth is the truth. There are no compromises. Christian life demands, so to speak, the martyrdom of daily fidelity to the gospel, the courage that is to let Christ grow within us and let him be the one who guides our thoughts and our actions." Benedict XVI teaches us that every faithful Christian is a proto-martyr. Pope Francis tells us that charity is its most essential ingredient, and Thomas Aquinas helps us understand why this is the case. I thank you for your attention.
We have a little over 10 minutes for questions and so forth, if people would like to Dr. Mateva will come to you.
I had a question about the ordering of charity. So you were talking about the common good. It's on. Can you hear me?
I hear you.
So you talked about how when you were relating to truth and justice, and especially with Father Pugliese's death, right, you said that he died specifically for the res publica, the common good in the res publica, it sounded to me. And I was a bit surprised. I thought you would have said that he died for the common good that is particularly associated with the city of God, and so that because of the corruption of the state, maybe he would have been dying for the common good, but for the justice in particular that is related to the city of God, because of the corruption here, that you need to orient yourself to a higher good in order to have a healing down here. But the later part of your talk maybe suggested to me a reason why you might focus on the res publica. Maybe you can talk about this. But when we look at today's society as being focused on the individual good, talking about the common good in society as being the good of the individual, not as something that we share in, so that maybe the death of somebody who dies for truth and justice is for the res publica insofar as it is a symbol also to raise up society to look not only for the good personal good, but for the good of those around them, and then ultimately orienting them to the city of God. Does that sound?
Broadly correct. But in principle, the logic in Thomas behind it is that there are certain virtues out there that are what he calls true virtues, that are and justice as the common good of the res publica as its end, because it concerns the flourishing of everything. And the flourishing of the common good is integral to the common good of the universe, as it is ordered objectively to God. And these acts can be referred by charity to God. That means they can be elevated and informed by charity. And of course, every proper act in the restored earthly city, in the civitas terrena, by the virtue of religion, orders the civitas terrena to the heavenly city, to the civitas Dei. And so that relationship is fundamental to Thomas. Now, that presupposes a political theory that is not quite contemporary political theory anymore, but I think it's the true political theory. We have to read Augustine and Thomas together next to each other on that, and especially chapter or book 19 of the City of God on that. But yes, that link is important. Certain acts for the city of God, and that even includes the defense of the city of God in war. You can say soldiers, Catholic soldiers who died in the defense of Poland when Nazi Germany attacked, you can say they were potential proto-martyrs who, as faithful Catholics, were defending the church that was eventually to be suppressed by the Nazis, but also the body politic Poland. But their matter, so to speak, was not the proper matter for martyrdom, because they were not dying voluntarily. They were not undergoing death without resistance. They were being soldiers. And so what they do was morally licit and is affirmed by the Catholic faith as a proper moral act, but it is not an imitation of Christ. So that's where the differentiation comes in. But there are other acts where a person might undergo death voluntarily for the sake of the civitas terrena, of the good of the res publica, referred by charity to God. And as we have now the judgment of the Church, this is indeed a proper case of martyrdom. And there we have suddenly a whole range of persons who come. Father Pugliese stands as a paradigm, a prototype for a whole category.
Thanks, Professor Hütter, for such a pertinent and rich paper. You mentioned in connection with those who were killed for virtue, numerous Christians who died at the hands of the Nazis. And this brings to mind the example of Maximilian Kolbe, who provides kind of an interesting and unusual example of a martyr. In that there's some respect, it seems, in which he dies for the sake of virtue, and yet it's not the sense that, say, John the Baptist does, where his particular act of virtue is what the Nazis are persecuting him for. Rather, he hands himself over in the place of a condemned man for an escapee. How does an example like that fit into the framework that you've explained to us?
Well, in the case of Maximilian Kolbe, I don't want to talk in a funny way about his case because he's such an evil, but I want to say it's almost a case of double duty. The fact that he ended up in concentration camp makes him already a martyr. He could have died there without stepping in for that person in particular. He was brought into the concentration camp for the sake of the faith. So the original odium fidei of the persecutors, the Nazis, was his commitment to the Christian faith, first and foremost. So he might have died without stepping in for this particular person. He would have still been maybe an unknown martyr.
What he
Right. Some who didn't die, they remain what we might call proto-martyrs. They're even, this is getting more complicated now, but let me just, the second part is that he stepped in for that person here in an act of justice. He acknowledged that this person he's stepping in for was a father who had obligations in the horizontal order in relationship to family and children. And so he also gave witness in the middle, in this setting, to the proximate natural law that he as a person, as a priest, steps in for someone who has proximate commitments and relationships. And this is also a witness to the Nazis that they were not only persecuting the divine law, they were also neglecting the natural law, what we call proper human decency and dignity. And he did a double act, you can say. It was also a double provocation of the Nazis, because even in the concentration camp he wouldn't give in and fold, but he would step in and show Christian heroism in the face of the persecutors, for which he had to pay them dearly. Does that...
Thank you very much for your talk. Every year, the Congregation for the Evangelization of Peoples lists a sort of honor roll of those who have died in the line of duty, those who were killed in the line of duty, usually in missionary places throughout the world. A couple of these I have known personally. One was our Father Thomas Heath in Kenya. Another one was a seminary rector who was killed in Kenya. Both were octogenarians. In one case, the robbers came into the Dominican house, beat Father Thomas up, and then he later died in the hospital. In the other case, they came into the seminary, into the former rector's office, and killed him right then and there. My question particularly is how, in some sense, the emphasis is on the motivation of the martyr, like his virtue, the dispositions, and in some sense, it seems that martyrdom is also dependent upon the motivation of those who kill.
Yes, that's true.
And sometimes it's just not clear what an evil will is intending. So sometimes people will just say, well, they were out for money. But, you know, if you're going after a religious priest in his 80s, is it really just a matter of money? And if you could just comment more about the intention or disposition that is needed for the persecutor or for the criminal in this act.
Then we need to make a distinction that I didn't work on much in the lecture between the public acknowledgement of martyrs before the church, I used the technical term, and what is martyrdom before God, the aureole. The martyrdom before the church we need evidence. The church needs evidence for acknowledgement. In other words, we have a lot more martyrs for sure in heaven than we know about and who acknowledge as martyrs before the church, because the criteria might be given, but we don't know. We don't know the last act of the attitude of the 80-year-old Dominican friar who might have forgiven his, in the act of being killed, his persecutors, or offered them up to God in an act, in a small intention that's between God and him, and we don't know. And we don't know, we will never find out the motivation, possibly the hatred of the faith, or the hatred of the kind of witness that they might have given, the preaching. Peter Martyr, you know, we have other, comes to mind. There we have the public witness of his killer who converts afterwards, and the companion, and so the church knows and can make an act. And very often, very, very often, we just don't have any And so there are, heaven is full of martyrs that we don't know and that the church hasn't acknowledged. That's Thomas and the whole tradition assumes that. But that's the decision between martyrdom before the church, where the church can make an act, and the martyrdom that brings about the aureole. That might even include soldier martyrs, possibly. Not for their warfare, but for something else that we might not know that has happened in the context of that war. But that can never be the case before the church, because the matter, there is an imperfection in the matter of the activity that we know about, namely warfare.
I fear this will be our last question, but it will give time afterwards so that he can take a few more in private.
Thank you, Professor, for your presentation. It was wonderful. I just would like to explore the question a little bit further about the candidates for martyrdom. With respect to Odium Fidei, it would strike me that the Jewish people were selected for extermination during the Second World War very much out of an Odium Fidei. These were the chosen people of God, and they were killed, I think, on the basis of that very claim. The anthropology behind the Nazis' extermination program was certainly and explicitly undertaken in Odium Fidei. So wouldn't that broaden the category of martyr? If anyone was a member of the chosen people, or a member of the Jewish race, and was killed specifically because they were Jewish, isn't that at least materially being killed in Odium Fidei and therefore apt matter for martyrdom? I know there has to be more to it than that, but would that not be a necessary or sufficient starting point?
Thank you for asking such a wonderfully complex and difficult question, Father. You're known for that. yes, I think you're exactly right. And so there is an aspect of what is integral to martyrdom that is the case. And I think the church would acknowledge it now in the present understanding of martyrdom. It cannot be made explicit because it cannot be explicitly acknowledged, for one, because we don't know the individual motivation that is part of it, and regarding the matter of martyrdom, we do not have an explicit commitment to the person and the truth of Christ. That's a complication that we know of. And of course, I was waiting. What is implied in your question is now, what about Dietrich Bonhoeffer and other Protestant martyrs? And the interesting thing is that book by Benedict XIV, in the third volume, he addresses that in a very thoughtful way. And he makes a distinction between, in that room I can say it, between formal and material heresy, which is a very important distinction. So some person can be materially a heretic without knowing it and be related to God and offer one's life up to God. And Benedict has something to say about that positively. Now, the church cannot acknowledge that. So before the church, that cannot happen because there's still an impediment here. But he acknowledges that as a possible case of martyrdom before God, because that individual person is personally inculpable for the heresy here. It's different for a formal heretic. But that isn't who qualifies, that's another story. But that distinction is a very important and helpful one for an opening ecumenical conversation on matters of martyrdom, at least in a form of an acknowledgement that can help us, I think, forward. We need to go sometimes back and dig in older sources. So Benedict XIV, in the third volume of this tome, you can find a beginning magisterial source of a distinction that would help for... But the bottom line, of course, is always clear, Augustine, on that. Authentic martyrdom relies at the core on the truth of the faith. That's the first criterion. The second one is that in the martyr, from the cause of martyrdom from the person side is union with God in charity. So a martyr who has dead, a person who has dead faith without charity, lacks a crucial precondition for martyrdom, because that person cannot offer up her or his own life in an act of charity to God, a person not in friendship with God. And then the question on the side of the persecutors, it has to be either odium fidei or it has to be hatred for God's law, basically, virtue and truth. But your question on Judaism is a very important one. The Nazis had were theologians, very bad theologians, demonic theologians, but they understood something, and they, you're exactly right.
Please help me to thank Dr. Reinhard Heydrich for this wonderful talk.